Case is number 14-1469, The Medicines Company v. Hospira, Inc. Mr. Haug, is that how you pronounce it?
Haug, correct.
Yes.
Please, the court, good afternoon. The central issue on appeal here is the claim construction from the district court. A number of errors, we believe, were made. First, the district court converted
Mr.
a product
supposing,
claim.
Supposing we agree with you on the court's claim construction on efficient mixing and
yes.
that it's incorrect. If we adopt your construction, is there a way to determine whether a particular mixing scenario has minimized the ASP9 by Galrudin levels before the batch is made? Because the patentee seems to say, well, you do it by testing afterwards.
The patentee does say you test what you get afterwards for sure in its examples.
And but he's asked, can you do it before? And he says, I don't know.
Before this invention, I think that's absolutely correct. You don't know. That, in essence, was the problem that they were solving, is that they had variable results when they were using the processes that they had been using, right? And then they recognized that for reasons unknown at the time, they got ASP9 levels, impurity levels that were too high. They were beyond the specifications that were approved by the FDA. And so then when they looked at the problem, that's exactly what the inventors did. They solved that problem by finding out what was going on, and also realizing that a maximum F9 level, namely up to about 0.6, made a new and different product and one that satisfied the specifications. And they figured out how to do it by looking at the processes and experimenting, and that's all set forth in the specification.
Why wouldn't, under your construction, efficient mixing be indefinite? In the sense that you're saying, first of all, that you don't have to know it in advance. And second of all, you say all it means is minimizing the levels. And I don't understand how minimizing the levels can be sufficiently definite.
Well, first of all, with hindsight, once the inventors made their invention as described in the specification, they explained, first of all, that the process even had any significance to maintaining the impurity level of
no,
the
but how can it be definite to say minimizing the level? How is that sufficiently definite? How does that give anybody any guidance as to what the number is?
Well, the guidance is... Well, first of all, I don't think the test for infringement necessarily is not the same as the test for indefiniteness. I think there's a clear boundary here for indefiniteness under the... I think it's the Starlight case. There's a clear boundary here. It's 0.6 or below. There are other limitations in the claim also that have to be followed, wherein the...
Well, sure, but the fact that some limitations are comprehensible doesn't mean that others may not be.
I don't think there are any limitations in Claim 1 of the 727 patent or the 343 patent that are incomprehensible of understanding where the bright line is.
What do you think in the 343 that efficient mixing means?
Excuse me? I'm sorry.
What do you think in the 343 is the definition of efficient mixing?
It is characterized, as it says in the specifications, defined as characterized by maintaining a ASP9 level below about 0.6. That's how you know if you have efficient mixing. And when you're observing it, you don't have precipitate, you don't have, which is what they had, that was the problem with the prior art. They were getting precipitates in the process and so on and so forth. But as far as, it's when you characterize it, you know you have an ASP9 level. And also, it's the definition of pharmaceutical batches in this claim where there is no dispute. A pharmaceutical batch is either a single batch that is representative of future batches, or multiple batches all made by the same compounding process. And the issue here is the court here went further and said the same compounding process means exactly this, and then they imported these limitations into the claims. And I don't think this invention is in any way limited to how you do it as in example 5. That's an example of one way to do it, and a good example. But efficiently mixing clearly to a person of ordinary skill in the art is a way to get to your point, to your S9 level and maintain that either with one batch that's representative of multiple batches, such as the case here, as found by the district court, or in multiple batches using the same process, which is what example 4 is. That's what it's looking. The study they did was looking at the 87 or 89 batches that were not giving an S9 level that was 0.6 or below. In fact, some of them were well above, 3.6 is an example. And that was the problem. And so the inventors did was they solved that problem of getting variable results. They also recognized after making more than 25 batches, they recognized that having an S9 level with a maximum purity level, 0.6, was very important, and that's what they claimed. And that's why they got the product claim. And that's what was prosecuted by to the examiner. And I don't think there's any question the examiner understood that the 727 was just a product claim based on those limitations, and the 343 was a product by process. And so, as I said, I think also I would like to illustrate, in the claim construction opinion, the court below, it's actually on page 6 of the opinion, it's A41, the court said, thus, although it is recited as a product claim, it falls into the exception that arises when the product's distinction from the prior art depends on how it was produced, and for when the validity of the patent depends on use of a particular process, the claims are construed in the manner that will sustain their validity, and it goes on, and he cites to this AFG case. Now, he's saying that I'm looking at the claims, both patents, and I'm looking at this product claim, and saying, well, yes, it's a product claim, but it falls in this exception that the process is needed for purposes of overcoming the prior art, maintaining validity. But in a motion for reconsideration that was filed after this claim construction opinion, the court said, I do not construe the patent against the background of all the relevant prior art of which I have no knowledge. I'm simply pointing out that during claim construction here, it was just claim construction. There was no summary judgment motion. There were no issues of validity or invalidity or infringement. And the court, in its claim construction ruling, found how it found, and it did limit the product claims to incorporate process claims. We think that was legal error. And even inconsistent, I think, with the later statement by the court in its response to the motion for reconsideration that it was not even aware of the prior art. The prior art, again, was not just the inefficient mixing. The prior art was S9 levels being made above 0.6. And he wasn't...
Suppose we were to adopt your construction here of efficient mixing and were to agree with you that efficient mixing is not a limitation of the 727. Wouldn't we then have to send it back on the obviousness question?
Well, I think the answer is yes. I think our position is it's not obvious because for a number of reasons. First of all, the prior processes that were used that are exemplified in Example 4, those weren't known. They were not public. They weren't public, so they're...
You agree it has to be sent back. The claim construction was pre-trial. At the trial, parties were limited to the claim construction.
Yes, Your Honor. You know, essentially what the district court did is it collapsed the two patent case into a one patent case, and the whole case was based on a product-by-process claim. Not only efficiently mixing should be there, but also efficiently mixing means high shear mixing, an RPM speed above 1,000, slow and controlled addition, all of these specific process limitations that the court took out of Example 5 and imported into its construction of efficiently mixing. And that's in addition to the problem.
But he seemed to be doing that in part because he thought the patents would be invalid if he didn't construe them that way.
I think you're right, Your Honor, because that's what I was just reading from his opinion, where he cites to the AFG case, I think it was, where it's an exception to where you have a product claim, you don't read process limitations in. He cited to that case. But clearly,
what about the on-sale bar?
Excuse me?
What about the on-sale bar? And these are huge numbers.
Yes. Well, Your Honor, well, first of all, on the on-sale bar, a few things. At no time did the medicines company, which is the patentee, ever sell anything before the critical date.
Well,
they also didn't make an offer of sale.
He did not raise below, if I understand correctly, the experimental use argument as being an exception to the on-sale bar, correct?
Experimental use was raised below, and in fact, I think there's a finding of fact.
Yes, it's in the district courts, but before the district court found that this qualified as an experimental use, you had not raised that issue, correct?
I think we raised the issue. There was a we raised the issue that these were validation batches and therefore were not commercial batches at all.
But you didn't raise the experimental use argument, right? Before the district court raised that sua sponte, correct?
I would have to look at the record as to whether or not we specifically said experimental use or we were just arguing that these were not commercial batches. Namely, they were commercial. They were experimental because they were made for purposes of satisfying FDA requirements. I don't remember if we specified it as experimental use.
So the sole issue is whether, because they were used to meet FDA requirements, whether that made it an experimental use?
No, that's not. Well, on experimental use, I think that may be correct. However, they were also...
Is correct?
No. I think it was more than that. I think that BVL was a contract manufacturer.
Let's assume that BVL made a sale. Okay? Let's put that aside.
Okay.
And that we rule against you when we find that there was a sale. The question is whether that doesn't count because it's an experimental use. And what made it, in your view, now an experimental use? That it was for FDA purposes? It was necessary for FDA purposes?
Yes.
Anything else?
It was not a commercial sale. It was not a sale by BVL. They were just making it.
I've taken that out of the...
Okay, you're assuming. beyond the fact that it was not made for commercial purposes in the sense of to sell prior to the critical date or an offer of sale was made or could be made, yes.
Or just only the FDA, only for FDA purposes.
I think within the category of what I said, yes, I think so. I think they were making a validation batch because they're required to by the FDA to show that they could meet stability.
The validation batches each had a commercial product code. Is that correct?
I think they had a code, yes. They had a code.
A commercial product code. And they were designated for commercial and clinical packaging.
Ultimately,
right?
Yes. They were, in fact, sold later on. And they were, in fact, sold. However, again,
what case says that if you do something for FDA purposes, that constitutes an experimental use?
What case says that? I don't know. I think I'm not sure there's any specific case on that.
No, I don't think there's a case either.
I don't know the case right on that. I really don't. But again, I would like to make the point on sale bar. BVL never sold anything ever, right? They only made these products and then they issued invoices and the documents in the file here and the testimony shows clearly.
But BVL sold it to you, right?
No, they never sold it to the medicines company. They only charged for their services in manufacturing a product. That's what they charged for. They never took title. They never had title to anything. They never bought the API, which you need in order to make the drug product. So BVL was given the API by
the
medicines
company. You
agree
that under the cases, if they were a supplier, that would count as a sale for the on-sale bar purposes, right?
Well, they weren't a supplier.
Stay with me. If they were a supplier, then their sale counts for the on-sale bar.
If they were a supplier, I think Your Honor may be thinking of the Hamilton Beach case. If they were a supplier and they actually had title and they actually issued an invoice and they sold it commercially, then I think under that case, yes, that none of that happened here. They didn't sell anything. They, in fact, charged for making the drug product and then delivered it back, actually delivered it to ICS, 3PL, which is another entity that was a warehousing entity. They never took title. They never sold anything. They warehoused the product. And then it went from the warehouse to ICS, who's the distributor, and they never took title. The distributor and Hospira here in this case argues that that distribution agreement, because it was entered into before the critical date, is an offer of sale. But it just simply isn't, as was found by the district court, that it was a promise to enter into a promise. In other words, it was a distribution agreement that said, we will allow you to distribute this product, and if you want to distribute the product, you have to issue a purchase order to us, which we can either accept or reject. And that never happened. None of that happened before the critical date. So I'm trying to make sure the record is clear here down below, and I think this is what the district court found, and there are findings of fact to this effect. And I don't think that the appellee here has shown that there was clear error in those findings of fact down below.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Howell.
Thank you.
Mr. Liela? How do you pronounce it?
We pronounce it Liela, Your Honor.
Liela. Okay.
May it please the Court. I hadn't planned to talk about what Mr. Howard finished speaking about, but I will say a word about it, and then I'd like to talk about claim construction. The whole question of experimental use was not litigated in the court below. As, to the best of my recollection, the words experimental use were never used by any witness or any lawyer during the course of the trial. It wasn't briefed in the post-trial briefing. The first time we saw experimental use was in Judge Andrew's opinion. And we would contend and agree with the concept that experimental use was not demonstrated in the evidence. And we think the court erred in finding that the sales from Bendenu to back to the medicine company were excused from the effect of the on-sale bar because they were experimental. They were not experimental.
What about the argument that they weren't sales at all?
I'm sorry,
what about the argument that they weren't sales at all, that BVL wasn't selling something?
So it is possible, I guess, it is possible to arrange, to make a commercial arrangement with a supplier where somebody in the position of a medicines company can have the supplier do everything but transfer the title back to the medicines company and somehow put yourself in a position where you can engage in enormous commercial exploitation of an invention ahead of the critical date and be able to come to court and make an argument that we don't, that our conduct doesn't implicate the on-sale bar because title never passed back and forth and therefore there was no sale. If you wanted to, you could arrange your affairs in that way. And it looks like you might be able to make a good faith argument that that's not an on-sale bar problem. We cited the special devices case. It says you cannot stockpile an invention in the way that the medicines company did pre-critical date and in the fashion that they did. And this idea that title has to pass is a hollow formalism that really shouldn't control the end of the day because it really is a formalism. And the point of the rule is to prevent this sort of commercial exploitation that we saw in the case of in the trial record in the case of the medicines company.
Well, discuss a little bit. What concerned me was that the commercial coating on the packaging. I want you to discuss that a little.
Yes, Your Honor. So all of the commercial documents generated in connection with the creation of the batches that became the validation batches, all of the documentation, the invoices and the coating and the treatment of those batches was exactly the same as one would have treated a commercial batch that was made using the old method. And as Your Honor is aware, by the time these validation batches were made, as the district court found, the invention was ready for patenting. There was a batch record that in great detail described what was to be done, describing the patented method. There were other documentation executed by the inventors showing that the invention was ready for patenting. And there was all this commercial documentation showing that these batches were to be treated like any other batch being created for commercial purposes. There were 11 batches that were made before the critical date, and the value of those batches by their reckoning, not my reckoning, but by medicine companies' reckoning, was over $100 million. In fact, substantially more than $100 million. That sort of commercial exploitation of an invention is not supposed to happen. And the reason why we have the on-sale bar is to prevent that sort of commercial exploitation without somebody filing a timely patent application. Now, if I can, I'd like to go back to the point about claims construction. So Mr. Hogg says that the claims of the 727 patent are pure product claims, and that's just demonstrably wrong. First of all, the literal language of this phrase, wherein the batches have a pH adjusted by a base, the literal language calls out a process step. Something has to be done. Somebody has to perform a part of a process in order for those claims to be infringed. And so it already has a process limitation baked into the 727 claims. So we know just by looking at the plain language of the claims that it is not a pure product claim. But if there were any doubt about that, the treatment of these claims during prosecution dispels the doubt. what happened during the prosecution of the 727 claims is that three times the examiner rejected the claims, and three times the applicant responded to those rejections by arguing that the claims of the 727 are different from the prior art because of the new pH adjusting step. So, for example, look at the joint appendix at page 678. You'll see that argument being made. And as part of making these arguments, the applicant also submitted the declaration of the inventor, Gary Musso. That declaration goes on in some detail about this new pH adjusting step and how this pH adjusting step is not found in the prior art. At least twice that I can see in the file history, the examiner told the applicant, that's well and good, but your pH adjusting step is not in the claims of the 727. So finally, to overcome a third rejection, they amended the claims of the 727 patent to add the pH adjusting step. And then she allowed the claim. So it's clear that they wanted to get a product claim, but the examiner wouldn't let them have a product claim and required that the pH adjusting step be put into the claims of the 727 patent. And then once the pH adjusting step is in the 727 claims, then so is efficient mixing, because the specification tells us expressly that whenever one performs the pH adjusting step, one must use efficient mixing. And you can see that in column 8, lines 54 and 55. It's also in the inventor's testimony. The inventor's testimony is summarized on page 14 of our principal brief, and I would refer you to that. But let me read one example. This is a question that was asked in the deposition of inventor Gary Musso. Question, the claims of the 727 patent require that the pharmaceutical batches claimed be made using high shear mixing? Answer, they require being made with efficient mixing. And there are several other examples cited in our brief where inventors gave that type of testimony. What emerges is that you cannot infringe these patents without performing efficient mixing. And it's supported also by a finding that Judge Andrews made when he found that the only difference between the claims of the patents and the prior art compounding process is efficient mixing. And that's in the appendix of page 27. Now, Mr. Hogg said that the judge was considering the prior art for purposes of construing the patents to avoid invalidity. I don't think that's accurate. I think, you know, this is an improvement patent. They had a way of making it. They think they improved it, and the invention was all about the improvement. And so the reason for looking at the prior art was to understand what was the baseline. How did they used to do it, and how do they do it now? What's different from how they used to do it? And the only difference is efficient mixing. So it would be illogical to not try to construe the claims in a way consistent with the plain language of the claims, but in a way that includes efficient mixing in the claims. And I was reading Phillips just the other day, and this language that suits this situation perfectly at page 1316 of Phillips, where the court, and the court there, the in-bank court, is quoting the Renishaw case. The court said, ultimately, The interpretation to be given a term can only be determined and confirmed with a full understanding of what the inventors actually invented and intended to envelop with the claim. The construction that stays true to the claim language and most naturally aligns with the patent's description of the invention will be, in the end, the correct construction. And that's what Judge Andrews did, and I would urge the court to adopt his construction of the wherein clause. Now let's talk for a minute about efficient mixing while I have some time. Efficient mixing is a coined term, so we have to go to the specification to understand what it means, because it doesn't have a meaning outside of the specification of these patents. And I think we can pretty readily set aside the medicine company's proposed construction, as the court hinted at in the questions that were directed to Mr. Hogue, that medicine company's proposed definition is a functional definition. It tries to define something by the outcome as opposed to the structure that accomplishes this outcome. And the problem with that sort of a definition is it doesn't provide any bounds. So there are no meets and bounds that you can use to determine if there's infringement. And under Nautilus, one could argue that such a definition would be indefinite. But more importantly, I think, for purposes of this case, is that we know that the medicine company's proposed definition is wrong because the specification tells us that it's wrong. The patents tell us clearly how to define efficient mixing in examples 4 and 5. If you contrast the 4, which is inefficient mixing, with 5, it is very easy to see what efficient mixing must mean. 4 describes a process where the pH-adjusting solution is added in an uncontrolled fashion, mixed slowly, and with a paddle mixer. According to the inventors, that's not efficient mixing. And by the way, that's exactly what Hospira does. So whatever the patent means, Hospira cannot be an infringer because Hospira is example 4, the old way of doing it that's not efficient mixing. In contrast, however, example 5 shows a process where the solutions are added at a constant or a controlled rate using a high shear mixing environment between 1,000 RPMs and 1,300 RPMs. So what Judge Andrews did, as he had to do, given what the disclosure in the patent says, he had to find a way to describe efficient mixing that accommodated it can't be example 4, and therefore it has to be what's in exhibit 5 that distinguishes, example 5 that distinguishes example 5 from example 4. And when one does that, one finds that the district court defined efficient mixing in exactly the right way that accommodates all of the patent documents consistently and protects the public's right to rely on the disclaimer in example 4. The public is allowed to read example 4 and conclude that is a safety zone, if you will. I'm allowed to do that because the inventors say that's not my invention. And so I won't say anything more about non-infringement, other than to just emphasize Hospira mixes very, very much in the character of Exhibit 4. The one tiny difference between the way Hospira performs its pH adjusting step and what's described in Example 4 of the patents is a trivial difference that has to do with the way in which the solution is added, the third portion of the solution after the pH adjusting solution is divided into 3 portions. And I don't think that tiny little difference between the way that Hospira does it and what's depicted in Example 4 is enough to take Hospira outside the safety of Example 4. Now I'd like to jump back to on sale, if I could, in the time that I have left, and I don't have much time left. But we were surprised, frankly, by the court's finding that the distribution agreement with ICS was not at least an offer for sale before the critical day. I can't account for it. I think Judge Andrews was a little bit confused. His opinion suggests confusion, that he may have thought we were arguing that there was a sale before the critical date. But we didn't argue there was a sale. We argued there was an offer for sale. And the aspects of the distribution agreement reflecting an offer for sale are pretty incontrovertible. For example, this is a three-year agreement.
We did argue that there was a sale with respect to the BVL transaction.
We did argue that there was a sale in connection with the BVL transaction. And the court found two things. Their title hadn't passed, therefore there was no sale. And he also relied on the experimental use exception, which was something that hadn't been litigated. But in connection with the distributor agreement with ICS, the court just seems not to have understood that this is a three-year agreement where under the medicines company was going to sell AngioMax to ICS. ICS is going to buy it, put it in its own inventory, and resell it in the exclusive territory of the United States. So both parties are highly motivated to be engaging in buying and selling of AngioMax.
You're getting into your rebuttal time.
I am, and perhaps I will save my time and sit down with my thanks, unless the court has a question.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Holland.
A few points. Page 18 of the district court opinion, the judge sets forth findings of fact. The first one is Medicines Company's invention was ready for patenting prior to July 27, 07, which is the critical date. We disagree with that finding. However, we won down below on validity, so we didn't appeal that finding, of course. However, that finding by the court, by the district court, that the invention was ready for patenting is clearly based on the court's claim construction, which is that this is about the process and the process only, the product by process claim, and of course he collapsed the product claim into a product by process claim. So what I'm saying is the court's finding that it was ready for patenting was based on looking at whether or not the process, as the court looked at it, was available at that time, which it was. But that's not the invention. The invention here was the recognition of an S9 level that is below 0.6, either if you have one batch that's representative as defined in the patent, or multiple batches by the same compounding process. That invention, that recognition of the invention, was not made before 2007 or July of 2007, which is the critical date. But again, my point I'm trying to make here is the claim construction really impacted and really infected all of the other subsidiary issues that we had in this case, including when the invention was ready for patenting. So we dispute that it was ready for patenting before 07, again, because it, with a correct claim construction, it wasn't.
Okay, Mr. Hyde, we're over your time, so I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay, sorry.
I have a final point on sale bar issue with respect to the distributor agreement with ICS, and it's this. We've cited to the court the Enzo Biochem case. The case is very, very similar on the facts to our case, and I don't want to suggest to this court that you're constrained by Enzo Biochem. I'm not brave enough to tell you you're constrained by it, but I will tell you this. I cannot think of a principled way to distinguish that case from the facts of this case. And with that, I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.